Hey, good evening and welcome to Bird Calls from the Knoll Foundation Studios here at Red River Radio. Tonight's program is made possible by the Knoll Foundation and the Community Foundation of North Louisiana. And we invite you to call in with your questions tonight about our feathered friends and the avian world at 800-552-8502. That's 800-552-8502. Cliff Shackelford is our resident ornithologist here at Red River Radio, and he's ready to answer your questions about birds tonight. Cliff is currently the statewide ornithologist for the Texas Parks and Wildlife Department, a position he has held since 1997, and he has been an avid bird watcher for more than 30 years. He is also the first author of the book, Hummingbirds of Texas, published in 2005 by Texas A&M University Press, and he has authored more than 80 publications on birds and birding. He and his wife, Julie, and her two children live in East Texas. And Cliff, welcome back.
Hey, Pil. Happy to be here.
Well, it's lucky that we're on the air tonight. For those you don't know, we took a lightning strike in the middle of the night last night and damaged quite a bit of equipment, but we've rewired everything. I posted some pictures of extension cords going all over the place on our webpage just for yucks. But we are up and running, and Troy Jones and Kermit were here most of the night, and I'll be babysitting the station overnight. We're still not 100%, but we are on the air with Bird Calls because the show must go on.
Must go on. I guess lightning is the biggest enemy for a tall radio tower. Huh?
Yeah, well, this wasn't even a tower. This was actually a box on the side of our building for ironically, our generator. So it was the transfer switch. So when the power went out, the transfer switch was fried, so we couldn't get back on. Wow. We had to reroute everything. So, but we are up on the air. So once again, we invite you all to call in with your questions at 800-552-8502. That's 800-552-8502. Cliff has driven up all the way from Nacogdoches to take your calls tonight, so we hope to fill up the radio lines with your questions. You can also email any photos you have of birds that you would like Cliff to identify to my address at wbeckett, that's wbeckett, B-E-C-K-E-T-T, at lsus.edu. wbeckett at lsus.edu. We won't get to them tonight, but we will get to them in a future show. And Cliff, at the end of last month's program, you gave us a conservation tip, and could you refresh our memories about that?
We ended the episode talking about avoiding erosion, and you know, it's amazing to think that sediment's the number one pollutant of our creeks and rivers, in other words, dirt. And it's typically from activities that we humans have caused that allows this loose sediment to wash into our creeks and rivers and muddy the waters. And that, you know, if you like fishing, that's no good. It's just not good for anything. So what we recommend is to eliminate or to avoid erosion is to minimize activities you do near a wetland. If you have a pond, a creek, a lake near your property, leave a vegetation buffer of at least 50 feet wide, if not 100 feet. You know, that means don't run tractors that are tearing up the ground that then can cause erosion when the rain comes or the water goes up. So if you have land that continues to erode away, be sure to establish native vegetation on it immediately, because the roots will help secure the soil. And that's, I think, the key to avoiding erosion is getting vegetation to grow. And of course, on this show, we only promote native vegetation that is supposed to be here and gives back to nature and so forth. And if you're a rural landowner who has a real big problem with erosion, you can contact your local NRCS district conservationist for technical help. That's a federal agency, and they can help you and give you ideas and plans and actions to stop the erosion problem on your property.
You are listening to Bird Calls with our resident ornithologist, Cliff Shackelford, and you can give us a call tonight at 800-552-8502. That's 800-552-8502. Any question regarding birds in the avian world are welcome. So please go ahead and get your calls in early. The earlier you get in, the more likely you are to get on quick. And Cliff, last month we talked about the upcoming Christmas bird count. Do you have any update to that?
Yeah, we... I participated in the Nacogdoches count. It was in mid-December, and it was an interesting day. The wind was really howling on that day, and the team I was on, we had an interesting bird that I thought was really neat. It's the Caracara. And then I heard about a week later that Tyler had their count, and they also had a Caracara, and I think they both might have been firsts for those counts. And that's not terribly surprising because caracaras have been slowly moving northward and into our area. They've been moving up the coast. You can see them down in the coastal prairies, even in southwestern Louisiana and in southeast Texas along the coast, the upper Texas coast. And that's a pretty recent phenomenon in the last couple, maybe three decades or two or three decades. And so the Caracara was a neat one to see. It's not something you expect to see in the Piney Woods. And then there were lots of typical of a Christmas count. You miss a lot of things. You're wondering, well, where is species X and Y and Z? And that's just the nature of the beast. So to kind of back up and give listeners an idea what the Christmas count is, it's a 15-mile radius circle that is you count all the birds in that circle during a 24-hour period every year during the Christmas period. There's a three-week window where you can hold your count, and you try to recruit as many people as you can. We get, I think, around 25 or 30 bird watchers that our compilers gather up and give them their marching orders. You send people into different areas so they're not double counting, and you try to cover that big 15-mile radius circle and count as many birds as you can, not just species but individuals. So what's interesting over time is you can see within that count things that go up and down sadly birds that are going down and don't ever come back up. And then you can see the opposite. You can see a lot of things that are going up and going up. So it's a way to get what we call a trend. And it gives us a kind of a snapshot of how bird populations are doing. And it's a lot of fun at the same time. So that's the Christmas bird count.
Interesting. Now I have an interesting question. I was taking some photographs the other night, about a week ago, and there was a tree, and there were all kinds of birds roosting in it. And I went in, got my camera, and when I came back out, it looked like they were gone until I zoomed in, and then I saw these little balls basically on all these branches. Is that the birds literally tucking their heads under their wings and going to sleep?
Probably so. Yeah, a lot of birds roost communally. So you could have seen starlings or robins or grackles or blackbirds. There's lots of species that will do that. And they'll pick often the thicker, bushier trees that provide protection, where they can not only hide from potential predators but stay out of the wind. And so you'll see that. That's probably what you saw.
Yeah, they almost look like little grapefruits at the tips of these branches in the you know what was left of the shrubbery or the leaf cover, and just thought, well, that's interesting. Either I've got a grapefruit tree out here, or there's a bunch of birds in that tree. So I'm gonna have to try to get a better picture of those in the future. So
yeah, cool.
Well, every month we do a profile species, and what do you have for us this month?
Well, this month I've been putting this bird off, I think, because it's so familiar. I think most people listening are very familiar with this bird. It's the American crow, and it's one of our listening area's loudest and most raucous species of birds, and we're going to listen to some crows here.
Yeah, definitely noisy.
Yeah. So I like the crow. I didn't put it off because I dislike it. I kind of put it off because I thought, well, everybody knows that one. But what I've decided is that we kind of have been profiling the more familiar birds or the more obvious birds, things that you can see. And so I probably should have done the crow in the first 5 or 10 episodes, but I didn't. So here he is. It's a long time coming for the crow. We don't have any ravens in the Red River radio listening area. So to see a raven, you'd have to head west to the Texas Hill Country or east to southern Appalachia. There's a smaller crow species called the fish crow that's found in certain parts of the listening area, but that bird sounds quite different from the American crow that we're profiling in this episode. The American crow has a tremendous geographic range in North America, occurring in all of the lower 48 states of the U.S., plus all of the southern Canadian provinces. For Mexico, however, this species barely occurs in a tiny portion south of San Diego, California. The American crow is all black, not really a shade of any other color on it, but don't be fooled by the glossy black that can appear, for instance, silvery white when the bright sun reflects off of it at just the right angle. This is a gregarious species, often occurring in large flocks, especially during the winter months. Some roost sites in the northeast U.S. can include thousands of individual crows. Some of those roosts, in fact, can contain upwards of 15,000 crows. That would be a cool sight to see. Crows have a very omnivorous diet, eating just about anything. They can be problematic with some crops, especially pecan orchards right before the harvest. Mm-hmm. Crows are members of the family Corvidae, which includes species exhibiting greater, quote, psychic activity, end quote, than most birds. In layman's terms, they use their heads a lot more than most birds. There are banding records showing that the American crow, if all goes well, can live at least 17 years in the wild. Crows, as parents, are fairly quiet and secretive when nesting as to not attract predators to their nest site, complete with tasty eggs or nestlings. When West Nile virus was first discovered in the U.S. a little over two decades ago, corvids were heavily impacted, but this species of crow has sprung back from any declines and continues to grace our fields, forests, and backyards. To see a photo of an American crow snapped by James Childress, please visit the Bird Calls page at redriverradio.org.
And you are listening to Bird Calls with our resident ornithologist, Cliff Shackelford. And you can give us a call right now. All lines are open at 800-552-8502. That's 800-552-8502. I had captured a recording, I think you had said it, of a fish crow up in Spring Hill a couple of years ago. And I was wondering, what is the difference between the two crows?
So the fish crow sounds like he's saying, no way. He's going, uh-uh.
Right.
It's real nasally, and like he's saying, no way. Very nasally. And so that's the fish crow. When you look at a fish crow by itself, you can't really judge size. It's really difficult. But sometimes they'll get together, especially in roosts, and you can see a smaller one. That would be the fish crow. But typically, in my experience, I don't see American crows and fish crows in our area sticking together. They pretty much stay separate. So I rely on voice to help me identify them, because otherwise it's the same bird on the same chassis, just a little smaller, and judging size in the field is very subjective and dangerous.
Is the fish crow also kind of a jet black kind of a color?
Yeah, he's identical. He's a mini-me of the American crow.
Oh, there you go.
Yeah, yeah.
Dr. Evil has to have a mini-me, so there we go. You are listening to Bird Calls with our resident ornithologist, Cliff Shackelford, and you can give us a call now at 800-552-8502. All lines are open. That's 800-552-8502. And in the meantime, we had a listener who sent in a couple of photos, and one of these was captured in the Davy Crockett National Forest portion of his father's cattle properties. And he had set up a trail cam, and he was looking for mammals because there had been a mountain lion seen in the area. But lo and behold, he came up with another image.
Yeah, this is a great blue heron, and you have these up on the website for people
Not
to see?
Yet, no.
Not yet, okay. So they'll be up. And what's really cool is it's right there by the camera. You couldn't get this picture if you were standing there with your handheld camera. So thank goodness for game cams, trail cams. This is a great example of getting a great blue heron right up front and close and personal.
You are listening to Bird Calls with our resident ornithologist, Cliff Shackelford, and you can give us a call right now at 800-552-8502. That's 800-552-8502. Any call about our avian world and birds are welcome. And we will get to our first call here in just a minute. But we also have another photo taken by the same person, but this one was shot in Southern California. And what you're going to do is see somebody holding a bird, which is normally kind of a no-no, but he wrote, this little one fell out of a nest and there was no way to return it to the nest, so he took the young hawk, and he thought it was a Cooper's hawk, to the wildlife rescue facility. So talk about that one a little bit.
Yeah, that's kind of a tough decision to make. No one likes to see an orphan baby bird, but we also should realize that mama and papa are going to do a much better job raising it. Even the rehabber will tell you that, the rehabilitator. But as a last resort, the rehabilitator can be a great resource. So we've talked about that in a past episode. You have on your refrigerator all the important phone numbers to call, and we all have 911 memorized for an emergency, but do you have your local rehabber on the refrigerator? So when you do find injured wildlife that you can take it to, but for young hawks like this, the best thing to do if you can't get it back in the nest, which is unlikely in every circumstance, is to maybe put it up on a fence top or put it up in a branch and a fork of a tree, because the parents will still feed it. So likely the bird is going to be flying any minute anyway. So, but it's a neat picture that this caller sent in to us.
I know years ago we had found a injured osprey in a parking garage. Mm. And so we called the wildlife experts. He'd broken his wing or something, fallen out of the nest, and he was a baby. And
right.
and we had called them, but we weren't going to. I mean, it was really frightened and just terrified and traumatized by anybody coming close to it. So we called the wildlife rescue people just to come and get it. So
yeah,
we didn't want to mess with it because we were afraid it would injure us or
right.
we would injure it.
Right. So have that number handy, because otherwise, guess what you're going to be doing while that injured critter is sitting in your possession? You're going to be fumbling around, calling everybody, and you're going to call your sister who knows somebody who knows somebody, and it's not the right, you're not going down the right trail.
Right.
So don't get caught in that situation. Do it when you have free time, when you don't have an injured critter in your possession. Find that number and have it handy on your fridge or actually with cell phones, program it into your contacts.
Mm-hmm. And keep in mind, mama and papa are probably nearby.
Yeah, and we really recommend that as being the first course of action, is make sure if it's a baby blue jay on the ground, just bring the kids and the pets inside and leave the baby blue jay, because mom and dad are still tending to it. You just interrupted their activity of raising that youngster. But let mom and dad raise their young. They're going to do a much better job than we humans.
There you go. You are listening to Bird Calls with our resident ornithologist, Cliff Shackelford. And you can give us a call right now at 800-552-8502. That's 800-552-8502. And we do have a couple of calls online, so we're going to get to our first one. Tom from Shreveport, you are on with Cliff. What's your question?
Hey, Cliff, really enjoy your show. Thanks for doing this for us.
Thank you.
My wife and I live in a neighborhood in Broadmoor in Shreveport, and we received as a gift a pre-built screech owl box for Christmas.
Mm-hmm.
And, it's got a kind of a peak roof, and it's got kind of a ledge on the front. It's sold for marketed for screech owls.
Right.
And we live in a standard subdivision. We don't have a big field and a post out in the middle of a pasture to put it on. So we put it where we could, which is about 15 feet up in a Bradford pear tree, which is leaf off right now, obviously.
Yeah.
And I'd like to hear your thoughts on that. Am I just creating habitat for the squirrels? And I'm going to hang up and listen to your answer. And I do appreciate you taking the call.
Okay. Thank you, Tom. Well, I think that the Bradford pear is probably the number one worst tree next to a cedar to put a screech owl box in, because when it's leaf on, stand back and tell me if you would be able to see it. And if you can't see it, a screech owl can't see it. So I don't ever recommend putting a screech owl box in a dense tree like a cedar, a juniper, a Bradford pear, etc. So if you don't have another option, you can put it on the side of your house. You can get a big tall pole, like a flagpole, and put it on the top of that. There are some people that will even ask their neighbors that they're friends with and say, hey, I don't have any trees on my place, but you've got some just a few steps across the property line. Can I put it on your tree facing my yard so I can enjoy it? So there are some other options you can investigate, but the Bradford pear, you're just going to have a hard time convincing a screech owl to move in. And a lot of the problem, not only is will the screech owl find it, but look at all the little runways that you're allowing predators and problematic other species coming in, walking in to your box. You want it kind of free of limbs. So I'd get it out of the Bradford pear and rehang it and do that ASAP, because an owl can't use it when it's on the ground or in the garage. So get it up in one of those other settings like I mentioned.
But would they like it if it was a freestanding pole completely away from everything?
Yeah, I've seen pictures of a friend of mine. She's near Wimberley, Texas, in Central Texas, and she didn't have a good tree. She put it on a pole, like a flagpole, and then put a predator guard on it, which was great, so nothing can shimmy up it like a snake or a raccoon or a squirrel, and the screech owls took to it. So she did have some other trees kind of shading it, but she didn't like the configuration of the trees in general, so she put it on the top of a pole. So I do some Googling around. You can find that kind of information and see how crafty other people are on this putting screech owl boxes elsewhere other than trees.
Okay. You are listening to Bird Calls with our resident ornithologist, Cliff Shackelford, and you can give us a call right now at 800-552-8502. That's 800-552-8502. And Amanda, we lost you, or Dawn, I'm sorry, Dawn from Henderson, we lost you somewhere in the process of transferring you. So if you would like to call back, we'd love to hear from you, but we have Kathy from Nacogdoches online right now. Kathy, you're on with Cliff. What's your question?
Hi, Cliff. During the Christmas bird count this year, we caught our local roadrunner for the count. And when we were walking in this one area, I believe we found where the bird, the roadrunner, is nesting, or where the roadrunner lives. And I've looked in my Crosley and Sibley, and I can't really find a good description of how the roadrunner's nest would look. It was back up in some, I'll call them briars or thick bushes, and it looked like a habitat. So my question to you is, do you know what a roadrunner's nest looks like in East Texas?
Yeah, and it you didn't describe it. So you might have described a thicket that they like hanging out in, but typically a roadrunner nest is up in a tree 10 to 20 feet up.
Okay.
And I mentioned cedar trees as being bad for a screech owl box, but I've seen them in cedar trees in Central Texas, and they stair step up those low limbs to get to that nest at 10 to 15, 20 feet up in the tree. So you didn't see a nest, they wouldn't be that low.
Okay.
So they're up in a bushy tree. And it's really tough. I mean, we see roadrunners in the winter, but it's kind of tough to find them at one spot year round. So have you seen this bird in the breeding season there?
Yes.
And two of them?
When we do our count every year, we've gotten the same family of roadrunners, I think, for the past 3 to 4 years.
Oh, that's
and
cool.
Then I found another set not too far from here.
Yeah.
So they're in this area. After the logging, we got to where we're just seeing one. But
yeah.
They're still here. So.
Yeah, so they're not going to really lead you to the bat cave, and I'm talking about the nest. Just like Batman's very secretive on the way to the bat cave, so is the Roadrunner. But if you see a Roadrunner flying out of a tree, a bushy tree at 10 or 20 foot up, that's not where a Roadrunner is typically going to be. I've seen them sitting up high to vocalize. They make a very mournful cooing. It sounds like an injured dog, kind of a ooh, ooh, ooh. Uh-huh. And then you can hear them do their bill rattle where they, you know, make a where their bill is slapping together in rapid succession. Sometimes they'll sit up high to do that, but if you flush one out of a bushy tree and you think that's an interesting setting, it probably is the bat cave. So it's probably up in that bushy tree.
So if they're not nesting, are they in the trees at night, or are they on habitat on the ground?
Yeah, I don't know. I've never seen a Roadrunner roosting, so I would bet they get up off the ground, like a lot of the big birds, like turkeys. That's okay. Another ground-dwelling bird that gets up high in trees to roost. I've never witnessed it, and I've never read up on it, but that's a good question. But I'm betting the smart Roadrunners get up off the ground, because that's where Mr. Bobcat is and Mrs. Coyote and everything else that's hungry on the ground. So you want to get up in the trees where you've got a little protection.
Okay.
Yeah.
Well, thank you so much.
Yep. Thanks for the call, Kathy.
Bye-bye.
Bye.
Thank you. And it's interesting. Roadrunners run on the road, but they roost in the trees. So
yeah.
So they are definitely planes, trains, and automobiles.
That's
so,
right.
So to speak.
That's right.
You are listening to Bird Calls with our resident ornithologist, Cliff Shackelford. And you can give us a call right now at 800-552-8502. That's 800-552-8502. We do have lots of lines open. And we have one caller online. Thank you, Dawn, for calling back. And you are on with Cliff right now. What's your question?
My question is, what's up with the crows in Texas? Since that's your theme animal for today, your theme bird, I wanted to share a contrast that I've noticed with the crows here in East Texas in a small town versus the crows that I got to know back in Seattle,
mm-hmm.
Seattle suburbs and in town. And they just seem to behave a lot differently, and I'm wondering if it may be because we have so many buzzards or vultures in this area, and they kind of compete for roadkill and things like that, that they seem to act a lot different here. And I'll give an example of what I'm talking about is back in the Seattle area, wherever I moved, I could train a crow to come on call and just give them a couple of calls, and that would indicate that I've got some food for them, some
mm-hmm.
traps or something like that. And, you know, within sometimes 5 or 10 seconds, you don't even see them, and all of a sudden they're just flocking in. And they would understand my signal that one call would be, I got your attention, and number two would be, I've got food, and I always kept consistent with that. And they're very easily trainable.
Yeah.
And here in my town, I haven't found that to be the case. They seem to be far away. They don't seem to respond to that. So I'm just wondering if the city birds are smarter than the country birds.
Well, in Seattle, you also had a different species, or a second species. There's also the northwestern crow, and I don't know which one you had tamed down or you know, worked with, if it was American crow or northwestern crow. But yeah, I've noticed urban crows in Texas are definitely a lot more approachable than rural crows. I think rural crows get shot at. They're not wanted, especially if somebody's got some crops growing. I mentioned the pecan orchard earlier. Anybody that likes to collect pecans from their own tree, they don't like crows because they're in direct competition. But I don't really have an answer for you other than, you know, what you experience is pretty neat, but might not be replicated everywhere. And I don't know if that's an indication of the species or just, you know, where you were, or maybe the northwestern crow is a little different than the American crow.
Should be. I wasn't aware that it was a different species, but they are highly intelligent.
Yeah.
There's been a lot of research at the University of Washington about the crows and how they recognize people's faces and you do bad things to crows, they will never forget.
Oh, yeah.
And even their kids and grandkids will know to watch out for you.
Yeah, that is a neat paper that has come out on facial recognition by crows. It was a researcher who was capturing them, and of course that guy had a tough time catching birds in the future because the crows remembered him. Seattle, you've got the two species of crows, and I don't know much about the northwestern crow, and I would never think my American crows that I've had anywhere I've lived would have been able to be tamed like what you experienced. So I think that's probably a fluke and hard to replicate.
Hmm.
Yeah.
Well, they're interesting birds.
They sure are.
And they seem to be doing very well anywhere across North America, especially the cities. They're so dense at the moment.
They've definitely moved into urban areas. When I grew up was a young bird watcher in Dallas and never had crows where my parents live, and now there are lots of crows and they're there all the time, and that's been in the last four decades that they've gone from zero to fairly abundant in the city. So there's lots of food in the cities. There's dog food bowls, there's scraps in dumpsters. You know, you mentioned vultures earlier. They're all eating similar stuff, roadkill and food that people drop, and so there are a lot of resources in the city that you know, it comes at a price. They've got to dodge traffic and flying into wires, and there's lots of noises in cities that affect birds. And what I mean by that is, for songbirds, they have a tough time hearing each other. Because they have to sing over loud sirens and machinery and weed eaters and all that. So it's just a different life in urban settings, not just for people, but for birds too. So, all right. Well, thanks for the call, Don. Appreciate it.
All right. And you are listening to Bird Calls with our resident ornithologist, Cliff Shackelford. And you can give us a call at 800-552-8502. That's 800-552-8502. Any call regarding birds or our avian world are welcome. And we are going to go next to Tony from El Dorado. Tony, you are on with Cliff. What's your question tonight?
Well, I have a question, a curiosity question about robins.
Okay.
I've over the years noticed robins in my yard going north in the spring. In fact, I think I saw some today. I couldn't swear to it, but I believe it was at a distance. And working their way across the yard as they go north. But I've never seen robins in the fall going to wherever robins go in the fall. And that was my point of curiosity, is where do robins go? And why don't they stop while they're going there?
Hmm. Well, you know, I think the one I'd like to say, it's a myth that is a good one to dispel, is that robins are harbingers of spring. I think that might work in certain parts of the country. It doesn't really work here. And we have lots of robins that spend the fall and the spring, the fall, winter, and early spring being very nomadic. And so I think you just have to be in the right place at the right time to see robins in those colder months. So I think they're in your area in the fall, but whether they're right over your head or in your yard is another question, because what they're looking for the most part are berries. And once they strip a tree of its berries, that tree is done for the year. So they have to move around, and that's where they're getting their nomadic tendency from. Is they're traveling around in big numbers, looking for buried trees, hollies, cedars, black cherries, etc. When we see them in the spring, we think, oh, spring is coming. It's a harbinger of spring. There's really not a day in the South that you're not going to see a robin. They're here all year round. So lots of robins, and they're doing nomadic things. And I think you just have to be lucky and to find them at that time of the year.
Okay, well, I guess that kind of answered my question.
Yeah.
They're not migratory, because
Yes, they are. They're highly migratory, and,
oh, okay.
And so, but that doesn't mean that they pack their suitcase and go to Natchitoches and undo their suitcase and spend 6 months there. That's not what that means.
They're not going to Jamaica,
but their suitcase never gets unpacked. That's why I'm saying they're nomadic. They're constantly moving around in search of food because that's the driver. If there's no food in the cupboard, you've got to move on to find food in the cupboard. Otherwise, you know what the result would be.
Okay.
Yeah. All right, Tony, thanks for the call.
Now, I did question being someone from up north in Ohio. Now, we never saw robins in the wintertime up
yeah.
there. So the robins do migrate out of there, and they return, that is, I think, where that folklore comes up, the harbinger of spring.
Yes, and I said that. I said it, in the south it doesn't work, but certainly if you're in Buffalo and Syracuse where you have brutal winters, it would work. Duluth, it would work, but not in Shreveport. Houston, Miami, those southern cities, it just doesn't work.
So all those times I exclaimed up north that spring is right around the corner because we saw a robin, that still goes.
There you go.
I just wanted to make sure I was on the right page there. You are listening to Bird Calls with our resident ornithologist, Cliff Shackelford, and you can give us a call right now at 800-552-8502. That's 800-552-8502. Any question regarding birds in our avian world are welcome, and there are lines open right now. We just have one call online. And Lorraine from Wynn Parish, you are on with Cliff. What's your question?
My question has to do with sparrows. Ordinarily, we would have finches, goldfinches, and I haven't seen one. But we are just loaded with sparrows. I know some of them seem to be the little chippies, but they're all small. We there have very few white throats. So what's happening with the sparrows?
Yeah, so one thing I didn't mention with Bill earlier with the Christmas count is how difficult it was to find American goldfinches during the Christmas count last month for our area. And there were several observers I talked to that would get, you know, 3, 6, 9 individuals when normally you could put a zero or maybe even 2 zeros on the end of those numbers in normal years. So I don't know what is going on with the goldfinches. We have a seed feeder, and I don't think I've seen more than 1 or 2 goldfinches on our seed feeder. So, but you're right, I've seen lots of chipping sparrows. That's really the dominant one down here in the south in big numbers, that you'll see them flying up from the roadside and twisting and twirling and getting out of the way, and you know, 30 to 50 at a time. Those are typically chipping sparrows. And you mentioned white-throated sparrow. We have those in our backyard. And I think the numbers are a little bit down from last year that we've been hosting. But at least there's still some birds there. And they skulk and hide in the thickets. They really like to get under bushes and shrubs. And in urban areas, that makes them very, very vulnerable to free-roaming cats. And we've mentioned this 100 times, is keeping our cats indoors is one of the best things we can do for our birds and other wildlife. So, Lorraine, I don't know what else to tell you except that you know, a lot of these finches and seed eaters are cyclical in nature. We see that with pine siskins and red-breasted nuthatch and purple finch. They have good years and bad years, and it's usually related to food availability. But an underlying theme that we've mentioned on this show, there was a big viral article that came out in September 4 or 5 months ago in the journal Science about 3 billion birds lost. Approximately 1 in 3 or 1 in 4 birds are gone, and gone forever because of things we've done, habitat alteration, birds, I mentioned cats, that's a big killer. Flying into windows and towers is a big issue. So we're just dealing with fewer birds, and I think, Lorraine, if you've been looking at birds for decades, you're going to notice that. Those are the people, the observers that have been doing this the longest are the ones that really can see the difference in the last few decades of birds just not in the numbers they used to be. And that's, I'm not happy about it. but at least I appreciate that that's out there, and I'm doing my darndest to make sure it doesn't get any worse. So keep watching your feeders, and hopefully you'll get some goldfinches. And thanks for the call, Lorraine.
All right. You are listening to Bird Calls with our resident ornithologist, Cliff Shackelford. And you can give us a call right now at 800-552-8502. That's 800-552-8502. Any call regarding our avian world is welcome. We do have lines open. We just have one caller online right now. Barbie from Pineville, you're on with Cliff. What's your question?
I noticed a bird the other day that I've never seen before. It looked like a crow when it'd come flying at you, but the last end of its tail feathers, when it flew over, the underneath was white, and then there was a linear line on its wings. I like to say where the meat part stops and the feathers start.
Yeah.
And the bottom half of the wings were white.
Okay. There's a big black and white woodpecker called the pileated woodpecker. Could it have been that?
I don't think it was. No, it was circling.
Circling. Hmm. And it was black and white. Hmm.
Did it make any noise?
Yeah. What was it doing? Was it vocal?
It wasn't making any noise. It was just flying around circling like crows do.
Well, I don't know what that could be. You know, we've had people call up that have helped with this, so I'm going to ask a friend to phone in. If anybody knows what Barbie could have seen, give us a shout, because nothing's coming to mind other than the pileated woodpecker. He doesn't have any white in the tail that you mentioned, but has a lot of white under the wings, and he's a large woodpecker that's roughly the size of a crow, just not maybe as husky or chunky as a crow, but certainly as big as a crow in dimension.
And if you
length.
Heard him, you would, you know, yeah. Here's the call.
Right.
Is it as black as the crow?
Yeah. And Bill's playing the vocalization of one. He's teasing us there with the call of pileated right there. Yes, it is as black as a crow. Yep.
And it wasn't making any sound at all. It was just circling.
Okay, and I don't know what it was you saw, but my guess is going to be a pileated. If it was as big as a crow and black with some white underneath it, it's probably a pileated woodpecker. So keep watching, Barbie, for that bird and see if you can see it again and get a better look at it. And boy, when it hits a tree like a woodpecker and hitches up the trunk, you know it's a woodpecker, because not many other things are going to do that. Mm-hmm. Certainly not a crow. So, but we don't have any other crows in the area that have white, and they're really in North America. There are no all black ravens or crows with white in the wings and tail, like you mentioned, not at all.
And I mean, you could see the lines.
Yeah,
it was distinct.
Yeah, so I'm at a loss, but I'm going to just take a wild guess at that it was a pileated that you saw, and we'll leave it at that, Barbie, until you can come back in another episode and tell us that you saw it and maybe even snapped a picture of it.
Oh, yeah, get a picture.
Yeah. All right.
I didn't think the peckerwoods would circle like that.
You know, I've seen pileated circle when there's an intruder, another pileated they're fighting, or if there's a hawk or an owl that they're mobbing. So it's not unusual. It could be that it's one of those scenarios, but you know, if it was circling around like a vulture, you know, there's, of course, two vultures that are all black or dark brown with some silvery that can look white if the light's just right, and they're circling around, you know, what we call buzzards, but I'm assuming that's not what you saw.
No, I know what a buzzard
is like. Yeah, so I don't really know what else you saw, Barbie, but thanks so much for the call.
All right. You are listening to Bird Calls with our resident ornithologist, Cliff Shackelford, and you can give us a call right now at 800-552-8502. That's 800-552-8502. Any call or any question regarding our avian world and birds are welcome. And And for those who didn't read the article that we were talking about a call earlier, the billions of North American birds have vanished, it is on our Bird Calls webpage for the Tuesday, September 24th program of last year, great, 2019. So you can look that up and read more about that and get more involved. And right now we've got another caller online. This is Robert from Shreveport. Robert, you're on with Cliff. What's your question?
Yeah, last year, I should say, about the time ducklings were being born and all that, saw a sight in my backyard that kind of amazed me, because the closest pond we got is the duck pond over on East King.
Mm-hmm.
Now, what I saw was a mama duck leading about two or three baby ducks from behind the garage along the fence.
Mm-hmm.
And where the fence met our neighbor's fence, taking a turn and heading on down back by the house. I rushed in and told my family. They came out looking, didn't see anything, and was wondering if I saw strange things. Now, I thought ducks and ducklings always stayed close to the waters.
Well, the wood duck, they nest in cavities and usually head to water. But that cavity might be at a pond, and they won't stay there. They will start marching. They'll march through the woods. They'll march through yards. So I'm guessing you had a wood duck. And also the reverse, sometimes they can't find a cavity near water. And so when they fledge, they've got to march to water. So I'm guessing you saw one of the above, and probably, you know, wood duck, and two is not enough. So that's one of the big challenges, for a wood duck, is she probably marched 10 or 12, ducklings through the woods, and along the way there were cats, dogs, hawks, everything, you know, kids picking them up. There, you know, turtles. There's, if when they do hit the water, they got to watch out for turtles and largemouth bass. Everything wants to eat a duckling. So that's one of the reasons they have large clutches, is you're not expecting all 12 ducklings to make it to adulthood. You're just trying to get one or two to adulthood, and so you were seeing, yeah, the dregs that survived whatever hardships. And some of the hardships can be a fence. It could be that she had to leave them behind because they couldn't get through a fence or around a fence, or they fell in a hole and couldn't get out. I mean, there's so many obstacles. Yeah. Can't fly.
I thought you might have nested behind the garage, but I couldn't look back there and couldn't see where anything that looked like maybe a nest or anything.
Yeah, if you didn't put up a box, a wood duck box, they'll use an old pileated woodpecker cavity in a dead tree. So that would be like in a pine, usually. And so if you don't have a dead tree with a lot of big holes in it, then probably didn't nest there, but it could have nested down the road, down the way, and they walked all that way. They'll walk miles to get to where they need to go. And it's difficult to get those ducklings, especially for a mama duck that doesn't have a whole lot of weapons to protect her young. She can feign, fake injury. She might be able to act tough and chase you with the wings beating. But she doesn't have sharp talons. She doesn't have sharp teeth, and everything's really vulnerable. She's just not really equipped to protect those young. So the idea is have large clutches and hope to goodness one or two make it, because good luck getting all 12 to adulthood. So,
well, I was just wondering, cause I'm thinking ducks aren't still close to water. And here's this duck about half away.
Yeah, and the wood duck is an exception. He doesn't nest on the ground like so many ducks, or on an island like a lot of ducks. He nests in a cavity, and if there's no cavity near water and they've got a nest, then they're going to be marching to look for water. And I bet you that's what you saw, Robert. So, all right.
Well, would this happen again? I mean, if I saw a duck, they might have a nest close by, and next year I'll see them again.
The chances of that are very, very slim. Yeah. So, just think of all the possible routes they could walk, and how many times you were looking out at that spot. The chances are tough to redo that scene. Yeah. All right. Thanks, Robert.
You are listening to Bird Calls with our resident ornithologist, Cliff Shackelford, and you can give us a call now at 800-552-8502, although time is running low. That's 800-552-8502. We do have two callers online. Johnny, I believe from Toddsville, Louisiana. We're not sure about the location, but you are on with Cliff, and what's your question? Where are you from?
Yes, it was... thank you for taking the call. It's from Pineville.
Oh, Pineville.
Pineville, yeah. And so the question refers back to what y'all said earlier about birds being in decline. What species have the greatest rate of decline? And also, are there any species that are actually increasing in our area? I know we have more bald eagles than we used to have.
Yeah.
And how these ranges are changing, I guess, over time, too.
Yeah, I mean, we could spend 30 minutes on this topic. You've posed some really good questions. I think some of the biggest declines have been in things like rusty blackbird, black pole warbler, evening grosbeak. Those come to mind. But everything has been shown decline. There are some exceptions. A lot of waterfowl, some of those are doing okay. Raptors are kind of a bright, cheery spot in the paper that raptors are doing pretty good. A lot of those are things like Cooper's hawks that are moving into cities, and guess who else is moving into cities? White-winged doves and Eurasian collar doves, which are on the dinner plate for a Cooper's hawk. So you know, that's, I would call that kind of a fake setting. But just about everything is declining. Those few species I mentioned are the more recent ones on decline. You know, we've been watching things like Atwater's prairie chicken, lesser prairie chicken, northern bobwhite, a lot of our gallinaceous birds. We've been talking about those in the conservation field for decades as declining species. And that's because we've just degraded the grassland habitats. We fragmented it to little tiny postage stamp size pieces of property for them when, in fact, they need giant landscapes to survive. They need large numbers of individuals of each species, and they just don't work in little postage stamps. So some birds on the increase, a lot of our urban birds, great-tailed grackles, ring-billed gulls, black vultures, Eurasian collar dove I mentioned. A lot of our urban birds are doing well because our cities are doing well. A lot of our trees that we plant to shade our houses are getting more mature and more protection for a lot of these birds. And we have bird baths that provide water. We have seed feeders. We have dog food scraps I mentioned earlier that great-tailed grackles will eat. So anyway, we could spend 30 minutes. It's a great topic, Johnny, and hopefully I answered your question rather quickly, but hopefully thoroughly.
Yeah, thank you very much.
Okay.
Thank you for the program.
Thank you.
All right, and you are listening to Bird Calls with our resident ornithologist, Cliff Shackelford, and you can give us a call now at 800-552-8502. That's 800-552-8502. Any question regarding our avian world and birds are welcome. And we're just about out of time, but we do have one more caller online. Eric from Alexandria, you are on with Cliff. What's your question?
Hey, thanks very much. I was calling about Barbie's report of a large blackbird with white on the underside.
Yeah.
And she said she knows buzzards, turkey vultures, and it wasn't that. But I was wondering, maybe she could call back and tell us what sort of habitat she was in. Was it suburban, or was it open agricultural fields? Was it pine woodlands, or...
Yeah, we're not going to have time for her to call back. So, Eric, what else do you think it could have been? Not knowing the habitat, just think about what she described. I was at a loss.
When she said she saw it circling, that brought to mind the turkey vulture right away, because and you said it that
she said no way.
Yeah, so that sort of rules that out.
Right. So I don't know what she saw other than pileated woodpecker. It's just one of those unknowns, and until she can refine it, we will never know, and we're just going to have to be happy with that.
No,
so
the mysteries.
Yeah. But thanks for the call, Eric.
And you are listening to Bird Calls with our resident ornithologist. And we do have one final picture to get to before we close out tonight's show. And this is from a Piney Woods listener who sent this in and wrote, interesting bird spotted on the shores of Lake Stryker in Cherokee County, Texas on December 5th. This person did not see it fly, but it bobbed back and forth as it walked, and they got a really up-close picture of it. And can you tell us what that is? And we'll put this up on our website in a little while.
It's almost a full-frame photo, and I wonder if they used a cell phone to do it, because it is a bird that you can it's very, very hard to see, and when you do see it, you can often get a close approach and snap it with your cell phone. And that's the American woodcock, and this picture, I'm drooling over it, that this caller sent in, because it is just fantastic. It's a plump bird about the size of a softball with a super long straight bill, a big giant black eye that's a little offset on the face, short little legs, and he's basically an a dry land shorebird. So he's related to shorebirds, but he doesn't really like to get his feet wet. He's not in the mud probing. He's usually in the woods or in little mucky areas looking for earthworms with that straight bill. So this caller sent in a really fantastic photo of the American woodcock. The colloquial name is Timberdoodle. If you grew up and Grandpa talked about seeing and hearing timberdoodles, that was the American woodcock. That is the American woodcock.
All right. And it's time for our conservation tip, Cliff. What do you got for us this month?
So this month we're going to talk about mulching your kitchen scraps. Are you sending vegetable peels and eggshells down through the disposal of your kitchen sink? Are you putting those banana peels and coffee grounds in your garbage can? All of these items that we normally consider trash can have a second life when mulched. They will enhance the soil to your backyard wildscape by providing much-needed nutrients. Consider mulching your kitchen scraps to feed your native plants, which in turn feed your birds. While there are compost containers you can purchase, it doesn't have to be complicated. Under our kitchen sink, we keep a covered container roughly the size of a bread loaf that's dedicated to collecting kitchen scraps. After a few days, when the container's full, we either add it to our mulch pile along with our yard leaves, or we simply sprinkle those kitchen scraps directly into our wildscape beds. Never include food scraps like meat or bones, because that'll attract raccoons, coyotes, and other mammals that will trample your plants in search of those yummy meat scraps. Eggshells, coffee grounds, and vegetable and fruit matter are all biodegradable and will help rejuvenate your native plants that our birds depend on. Put those kitchen sink nutrients back into the ground and not the landfill. Do it for the birds.
And all that mulching does improve the soil.
I've
experienced that. Well, Cliff, I want to thank you once again for joining us for another edition of Bird Calls. And coming up all the way through all of this rain and torrential misery for this show.
No problem. Thank you, Bill. And I like how you insert these bird sounds in the middle of calls. And when we're talking about Pileated woodpecker, you played that one, and keep up the good work.
I think that's my favorite bird call, to be honest with you. Of all of them, that's one of my favorites. So, all right, you have been listening to Bird Calls with Cliff Shackelford, our resident ornithologist here at Red River Radio and the state ornithologist for the Texas Parks and Wildlife Department. We'd like to thank everyone at the Texas Parks and Wildlife Department for their help with this program tonight. Tonight's program is made possible by the Knoll Foundation and the Community Foundation of North Louisiana. Bird Calls is produced by Bill Beckett and Cliff Shackelford, and we had help tonight from Wally Derleth, Tim Schnell, and Sheila Lawrence. The sound files used on tonight's profile species were from xenocanto.org and were recorded by Paul Marvin. This month's bird photo of the beautiful American crow was taken by James Childress. The audio for tonight's program will be posted on our website in the next few hours, and you can listen to the program again on our website, redriverradio.org. And remember, if you have a photo of a bird that you would like Cliff to identify, you can send it to me at wbeckett@lsus.edu. Hopefully you will join us next month for the next edition of Bird Calls on Tuesday, February 11th. In the meantime, this is Red River Radio, and thanks for joining us tonight.